She'd give aid to anyone if it meant having the Yankees come down on her like a swarm of hornets. No. She would bar the door against anyone needing help, except, of course, Ashley. For weeks after Tony's brief visit, she woke from uneasy dreams at any sound in the road outside, fearing it might be Ashley trying to make his escape, fleeing to Texas because of the aid he had given Tony. She didn't know how matters stood with him, for they didn't dare write to Tara about Tony's midnight visit. Their letters might be intercepted by the Yankees and bring trouble upon the plantation as well. But when weeks went by and they heard no bad news, they knew that Ashley had somehow come clear. And finally, the Yankees ceased annoying them. But even this relief didn't free Scarlett from the state of dread which began when Tony came knocking at their door, a dread which was worse than the quaking fear of the siege shells, worse even than the terror of Sherman's men during the last days of the war. It was as if Tony's appearance that wild, rainy night had stripped merciful blinders from her eyes and forced her to see the true uncertainty of her life. Looking about her that cold spring of 1866, Scarlett realized what was facing her and the whole South. She might plan and scheme. She might work harder than her slaves had ever worked. She might succeed in overcoming all of her hardships. She might, through dint of determination, solve problems for which her earlier life had provided no training at all. But for all her labor and sacrifice and resourcefulness, her small beginnings purchased at so great a cost might be snatched away from her at any minute. And should this happen, she had no legal rights, no legal redress, except those same drumhead courts of which Tony had spoken so bitterly, those military courts with their arbitrary powers. Only the Negroes had rights or redress these days. The Yankees had the South prostrate, and they intended to keep it so. The South had been tilted as by a giant malicious hand, and those who had once ruled were now more helpless than their former slaves had ever been. Georgia was heavily garrisoned with troops, and Atlanta had more than its share. The commandants of the Yankee troops in the various cities had complete power, even the power of life and death, over the civilian population, and they used that power. They could and did imprison citizens for any cause, or no cause, seize their property, hang them. They could and did harass and hamstring them with conflicting regulations about the operation of their business, the wages they must pay their servants, what they should say in public and private utterances, and what they should write in newspapers. They regulated how, when, and where they must dump their garbage, and they decided what songs the daughters and wives of ex-Confederates could sing, so that the singing of Dixie or Bonnie Blue Flag became an offense only a little less serious than treason. They ruled that no one could get a letter out of the post office without taking the ironclad oath, and in some instances, they even prohibited the issuance of marriage licenses unless the couples had taken the hated oath. The newspapers were so muzzled that no public protests could be raised against the injustices or depredations of the military. And individual protests were silenced with jail sentences. The jails were full of prominent citizens, and there they stayed without hope of early trial. Trial by jury and the law of habeas corpus were practically suspended. The civil courts still functioned after a fashion, but they functioned at the pleasure of the military, who could and did interfere with their verdicts, so that citizens so unfortunate as to get arrested were virtually at the mercy of the military authorities. And so many did get arrested. The very suspicion of seditious utterances against the government, suspected complicity in the Ku Klux Klan, or complaint by a Negro that a white man had been uppity to him, were enough to land a citizen in jail. proof and evidence were not needed. The accusation was sufficient. And thanks to the incitement of the Freedmen's Bureau, Negroes could always be found who were willing to bring accusations. The Negroes had not yet been given the right to vote, but the North was determined that they should vote, and equally determined that their vote should be friendly to the North. With this in mind, nothing was too good for the Negroes. The Yankee soldiers backed them up in anything they chose to do, and the surest way for a white person to get himself in trouble was to bring a complaint of any kind against a Negro. The former slaves were now the lords of creation. And with the aid of the Yankees, the lowest and most ignorant ones were on top. The better class of them, scorning freedom, were suffering as severely as their white masters. Thousands of house servants, the highest caste in the slave population, remained with their white folks, doing manual labor which had been beneath them in the old days. Many loyal field hands also refused to avail themselves of the new freedom. But the hordes of trashy free-issue niggers, who were causing most of the trouble, were drawn largely from the field hand class. In slave days, these lowly blacks had been despised by the house Negroes and yard Negroes as creatures of small worth. Just as Ellen had done, other plantation mistresses throughout the South had put the pickaninnies through courses of training and elimination to select the best of them for the positions of greater responsibility. Those consigned to the fields were the ones least willing or able to learn, the least energetic, the least honest and trustworthy, the most vicious and brutish. And now this class, the lowest in the black social order, was making life a misery for the South. Aided by the unscrupulous adventurers who operated the Freedmen's Bureau, and urged on by a fervor of Northern hatred almost religious in its fanaticism, the former field hands found themselves suddenly elevated to the seats of the mighty. There they conducted themselves as creatures of small intelligence might naturally be expected to do, like monkeys or small children turned loose among treasured objects whose value is beyond their comprehension, they ran wild, either from perverse pleasure in destruction or simply because of their ignorance. To the credit of the Negroes, including the least intelligent of them, few were actuated by malice, and those few had usually been mean niggers, even in slave days. But they were, as a class, childlike in mentality, easily led, and from long habit accustomed to taking orders. Formerly, their white masters had given the orders. Now they had a new set of masters, the Bureau and the carpetbaggers, and their orders were, "You're just as good as any white man, so act that way. Just as soon as you can vote the Republican ticket, you're going to have the white man's property. It's as good as yours now. Take it if you can get it." Dazzled by these tales, freedom became a never-ending picnic, a barbecue every day of the week, a carnival of idleness and theft and insolence. Country Negroes flocked into the cities, leaving the rural districts without labor to make the crops. Atlanta was crowded with them, and still they came by the hundreds, lazy and dangerous as a result of the new doctrines being taught them. Packed into squalid cabins, smallpox, typhoid, and tuberculosis broke out among them. Accustomed to the care of their mistresses when they were ill in slave days, they didn't know how to nurse themselves or their sick. Relying upon their masters in the old days to care for their aged and their babies, they now had no sense of responsibility for their helpless. And the Bureau was far too interested in political matters to provide the care the plantation owners had once given. Abandoned Negro children ran like frightened animals about the town until kind-hearted white people took them into their kitchens to raise. Aged country darkies, deserted by their children, bewildered and panic-stricken in the bustling town, sat on the curbs and cried to the ladies who passed,
"Mistress, please, ma'am, write my old master down in Fayette County that I's up here. He'll come take his old nigger home again. For God, I done got enough dis freedom."
The Freedmen's Bureau, overwhelmed by the numbers who poured in upon them, realized too late a part of the mistake and tried to send them back to their former owners. They told the Negroes that if they would go back, they would go as free workers, protected by written contracts specifying wages by the day. The old darkies went back to the plantations gladly, making a heavier burden than ever on the poverty-stricken planters, who had not the heart to turn them out. But the young ones remained in Atlanta. They didn't want to be workers of any kind anywhere. Why work when the belly is full? For the first time in their lives, the Negroes were able to get all the whiskey they might want. In slave days, it was something they never tasted except at Christmas, when each one received a drap along with his gift. Now they had not only the bureau agitators and the carpetbaggers urging them on, but the incitement of whiskey as well, and outrages were inevitable. Neither life nor property was safe from them, and the white people, unprotected by law, were terrorized. Men were insulted on the streets by drunken blacks. Houses and barns were burned at night. Horses and cattle and chickens stolen in broad daylight. Crimes of all varieties were committed, and few of the perpetrators were brought to justice. But these ignominies and dangers were as nothing compared with the perils of white women, many bereft by the war of male protection, who lived alone in the outlying districts and on lonely roads. It was the large number of outrages on women and the ever-present fear for the safety of their wives and daughters that drove Southern men to cold and trembling fury and caused the Ku Klux Klan to spring up overnight. And it was against this nocturnal organization that the newspapers of the North cried out most loudly, never realizing the tragic necessity that brought it into being. The North wanted every member of the Ku Klux hunted down and hanged. Because they had dared take the punishment of crime into their own hands, at a time when the ordinary processes of law and order had been overthrown by the invaders. Here was the astonishing spectacle of half a nation attempting, at the point of bayonet, to force upon the other half the rule of Negroes, many of them scarcely one generation out of the African jungles. The vote must be given to them, but it must be denied to most of their former owners. The South must be kept down, and disfranchisement of the whites was one way to keep the South down. Most of those who had fought for the Confederacy, held office under it, or given aid and comfort to it, were not allowed to vote, had no choice in the selection of their public officials, and were wholly under the power of an alien rule. Many men, thinking soberly of General Lee's words and example, wished to take the oath, become citizens again, and forget the past. But they were not permitted to take it. Others, who were permitted to take the oath, hotly refused to do so, scorning to swear allegiance to a government which was deliberately subjecting them to cruelty and humiliation. Scarlett heard over and over until she could have screamed at the repetition. "I'd have taken their damned oath right after the surrender if they'd acted decent. I can be restored to the Union, but by God, I can't be reconstructed into it." Through these anxious days and nights, Scarlett was torn with fear. The ever-present menace of lawless Negroes and Yankee soldiers preyed on her mind. The danger of confiscation was constantly with her, even in her dreams, and she dreaded worse terrors to come. Depressed by the helplessness of herself and her friends, of the whole South. It wasn't strange, she often remembered during these days, the words which Tony Fontaine had spoken so passionately. By God, Scarlet, it isn't to be borne. And it won't be borne. In spite of war, fire, and reconstruction, Atlanta had again become a boom town. In many ways, the place resembled the busy young city of the Confederacy's early days. The only trouble was that the soldiers crowding the streets were the wrong kind of uniforms. The money was in the hands of the wrong people, and the Negroes were living in leisure while their former masters struggled and starved. Underneath the surface were misery and fear, but all the outward appearances were those of a thriving town that was rapidly rebuilding from its ruins, a bustling, hurrying town. Atlanta, it seemed, must always be hurrying, no matter what its circumstances might be. Savannah, Charleston, Augusta, Richmond, New Orleans would never hurry. It was ill-bred and Yankeefied to hurry. But in this period, Atlanta was more ill-bred and Yankeefied than it had ever been before, or would ever be again. With new people thronging in from all directions, the streets were choked and noisy from morning till night. The shiny carriages of Yankee officers' wives and newly rich carpetbaggers splashed mud on the dilapidated buggies of the townspeople. And gaudy new homes of wealthy strangers crowded in among the sedate dwellings of older citizens. The war had definitely established the importance of Atlanta in the affairs of the South, and the hitherto obscure town was now known far and wide. The railroads for which Sherman had fought an entire summer and killed thousands of men were again stimulating the life of the city they had brought into being. Atlanta was again the center of activities for a wide region, as it had been before its destruction, and the town was receiving a great influx of new citizens, both welcome and unwelcome. Invading carpetbaggers made Atlanta their headquarters, and on the streets they jostled against representatives of the oldest families in the South, who were likewise newcomers in the town. Families from the country districts, who had been burned out during Sherman's march, and who could no longer make a living without the slaves to till the cotton, had come to Atlanta to live. New settlers were coming in every day from Tennessee and the Carolinas, where the hand of Reconstruction lay even heavier than in Georgia. Many Irish and Germans, who had been bounty men in the Union Army, had settled in Atlanta after their discharge. The wives and families of the Yankee garrison, filled with curiosity about the South after 4 years of war, came to swell the population. Adventurers of every kind swarmed in, hoping to make their fortunes, and the Negroes from the country continued to come by the hundreds. The town was roaring, wide open like a frontier village, making no effort to cover its vices and sins. Saloons blossomed overnight, two and sometimes three in a block. And after nightfall the streets were full of drunken men, black and white, reeling from wall to curb and back again. Thugs, pickpockets, and prostitutes lurked in the unlit alleys and shadowy streets. Gambling houses ran full blast, and hardly a night passed without its shooting or cutting affray. Respectable citizens were scandalized to find that Atlanta had a large and thriving red light district, larger and more thriving than during the war. All night long, pianos jangled from behind drawn shades, and rowdy songs and laughter floated out, punctuated by occasional screams and pistol shots. The inmates of these houses were bolder than the prostitutes of the war days, and brazenly hung out of their windows and called to passers-by. And on Sunday afternoons, the handsome closed carriages of the madams of the district rolled down the main streets, filled with girls in their best finery, taking the air from behind lowered silk shades. Belle Watling was the most notorious of the madams. She had opened a new house of her own, a large two-story building that made neighboring houses in the district look like shabby rabbit warrens. There was a long bar room downstairs, elegantly hung with oil paintings, and a Negro orchestra played every night. The upstairs, so rumor said, was fitted out with the finest of plush upholstered furniture, heavy lace curtains, and imported mirrors in gilt frames. The dozen young ladies with whom the house was furnished were comely, if brightly painted, and comported themselves more quietly than those of other houses. At least, the police were seldom summoned to Bell's. This house was something that the matrons of Atlanta whispered about furtively, and ministers preached against in guarded terms as a cesspool of iniquity, a hissing and a reproach. Everyone knew that a woman of Belle's type couldn't have made enough money by herself to set up such a luxurious establishment. She had to have a backer, and a rich one at that. And Rhett Butler had never had the decency to conceal his relations with her, so it was obvious that he, and no other, must be that backer. Belle herself presented a prosperous appearance when glimpsed occasionally in her closed carriage, driven by an impudent yellow Negro. When she drove by, behind a fine pair of bays, all the little boys along the street, who could evade their mothers, ran to peer at her and whisper excitedly, "That's her! That's old Belle! I seen her red hair!" Shouldering the shell-pitted houses patched with bits of old lumber and smoke-blackened bricks, the fine homes of the carpetbaggers and war profiteers were rising, with mansard roofs, gables and turrets, stained-glass windows and wide lawns. Night after night, in these newly built homes, the windows were ablaze with gaslight, and the sound of music and dancing feet drifted out upon the air. Women in stiff, bright-colored silk strolled about long verandas, squired by men in evening clothes. Champagne corks popped, and on lace tablecloths 7-course dinners were laid. Hams in wine, pressed duck, pâté de foie gras. Rare fruits in and out of season were spread in profusion. Behind the shabby doors of the old houses, poverty and hunger lived, all the more bitter for the brave gentility with which they were born, all the more pinching for the outward show of proud indifference to material wants. Dr. Meade could tell unlovely stories of those families who had been driven from mansions to boarding houses, and from boarding houses to dingy rooms on back streets. He had too many lady patients who were suffering from weak hearts and declines. He knew, and they knew he knew, that slow starvation was the trouble. He could tell of consumption making inroads on entire families, and of pellagra, once found only among poor whites, which was now appearing in Atlanta's best families. And there were babies with thin, rickety legs, and mothers who could not nurse them. Once the old doctor had been wont to thank God reverently for each child he brought into the world. Now he didn't think life was such a boon. It was a hard world for little babies, and so many died in their first few months of life. Bright lights and wine, fiddles and dancing, brocade and broadcloth in the showy big houses, and just around the corners, slow starvation and cold. Arrogance and callousness for the conquerors, bitter endurance and hatred for the conquered. Chapter 38. Scarlett saw it all, lived with it by day, took it to bed with her at night, dreading always what might happen next. She knew that she and Frank were already in the Yankees' black books, because of Tony. And disaster might descend on them at any hour. But now, of all times, she couldn't afford to be pushed back to her beginnings. Not now, with a baby coming. The mill just commencing to pay, and Tara depending on her for money until the cotton came in the fall. Oh, suppose she should lose everything. Suppose she should have to start all over again with only her puny weapons against this mad world. To have to pit her red lips and green eyes and her shrewd, shallow brain against the Yankees and everything the Yankees stood for. Weary with dread, she felt that she would rather kill herself than try to make a new beginning. In the ruin and chaos of that spring of 1866, she single-mindedly turned her energies to making the mill pay. There was money in Atlanta. The wave of rebuilding was giving her the opportunity she wanted, and she knew she could make money if only she could stay out of jail. But she told herself time and again she would have to walk easily, gingerly, be meek under insults, yielding to injustices, never giving offense to anyone, black or white, who might do her harm. She hated the impudent free Negroes as much as anyone, and her flesh crawled with fury every time she heard their insulting remarks and high-pitched laughter as she went by. But she never even gave them a glance of contempt. She hated the carpetbaggers and scalawags who were getting rich with ease while she struggled, but she said nothing in condemnation of them. No one in Atlanta could have loathed the Yankees more than she, for the very sight of a blue uniform made her sick with rage, but even in the privacy of her family she kept silent about them. "I won't be a big-mouthed fool," she thought grimly. "Let others break their hearts over the old days and the men who'll never come back. Let others burn with fury over the Yankee rule and losing the ballot. Let others go to jail for speaking their minds and get themselves hanged for being in the Ku Klux Klan." Oh, what a dreaded name that was, almost as terrifying to Scarlett as to the Negroes. Let other women be proud that their husbands belonged. Thank God Frank had never been mixed up in it. Let others stew and fume and plot and plan about things they could not help. What did the past matter compared with the tense present and the dubious future? What did the ballot matter when bread, a roof, and staying out of jail were the real problems? And please, God, just let me stay out of trouble until June. Only till June. By that month, Scarlett knew she would be forced to retire into Aunt Pitty's house and remain secluded there until after her child was born. Already people were criticizing her for appearing in public when she was in such a condition. No lady ever showed herself when she was pregnant. Already Frank and Pitty were begging her not to expose herself, and them, to embarrassment. And she had promised them to stop work in June. Only till June. By June she must have the mill well enough established for her to leave it. By June she must have money enough to give her at least some little protection against misfortune. So much to do and so little time to do it. She wished for more hours of the day and counted the minutes, as she strained forward feverishly in her pursuit of money and still more money. Because she nagged the timid Frank, the store was doing better now, and he was even collecting some of the old bills. But it was the sawmill on which her hopes were pinned. Atlanta these days was like a giant plant which had been cut to the ground, but now was springing up again with sturdier shoots, thicker foliage, more numerous branches. The demand for building materials was far greater than could be supplied. Prices of lumber, brick, and stone soared, and Scarlett kept the mill running from dawn until lantern light. A part of every day she spent at the mill, prying into everything, doing her best to check the thievery she felt sure was going on. But most of the time she was riding about the town making the rounds of builders, contractors, and carpenters, even calling on strangers she had heard might build at future dates, cajoling them into promises of buying from her and her only. Soon she was a familiar sight on Atlanta streets, sitting in her buggy beside the dignified, disapproving old darky driver. A lap robe pulled high about her, her little mittened hands clasped in her lap. Aunt Pitty made her a pretty green mantelette, which hid her figure, and a green pancake hat which matched her eyes, and she always wore these becoming garments on her business calls. A faint dab of rouge on her cheeks and a fainter fragrance of cologne made her a charming picture, as long as she didn't alight from the buggy and show her figure. And there was seldom any need for this, for she smiled and beckoned, and the men came quickly to the buggy and frequently stood bareheaded in the rain to talk business with her. She was not the only one who had seen the opportunities for making money out of lumber, but she didn't fear her competitors. She knew with conscious pride in her own smartness that she was the equal of any of them. She was Gerald's own daughter, and the shrewd trading instinct she had inherited was now sharpened by her needs. At first the other dealers had laughed at her, laughed with good-natured contempt at the very idea of a woman in business. But now they didn't laugh. They swore silently as they saw her ride by. The fact that she was a woman frequently worked in her favor, for she could upon occasion look so helpless and appealing that she melted hearts. With no difficulty whatever, she could mutely convey the impression of a brave but timid lady, forced by brutal circumstance into a distasteful position. A helpless little lady who would probably starve if customers didn't buy her lumber. But when ladylike airs failed to get results, she was coldly businesslike and willingly undersold her competitors at a loss to herself if it would bring her a new customer. She was not above selling a poor grade of lumber for the price of good lumber if she thought she would not be detected. And she had no scruples about blackguarding the other lumber dealers. With every appearance of reluctance at disclosing the unpleasant truth, she would sigh and tell prospective customers that her competitor's lumber was far too high in price, rotten, full of knot-holes, and, in general, of deplorably poor quality. The first time Scarlett lied in this fashion, she felt disconcerted and guilty. Disconcerted because the lie sprang so easily and naturally to her lips. Guilty because the thought flashed into her mind, what would Mother say? There was no doubt what Ellen would say to a daughter who told lies and engaged in sharp practices. She would be stunned and incredulous and would speak gentle words that stung despite their gentleness, would talk of honor and honesty and truth and duty to one's neighbor. Momentarily, Scarlett cringed as she pictured the look on her mother's face. And then the picture faded, blotted out by an impulse, hard, unscrupulous, and greedy, which had been born in the lean days at Tara and was now strengthened by the present uncertainty of life. So she passed this milestone as she had passed others before it, with a sigh that she was not as Ellen would like her to be, a shrug, and the repetition of her unfailing charm, "I'll think of all this later." But she never again thought of Ellen in connection with her business practices, never again regretted any means she used to take trade away from other lumber dealers. She knew she was perfectly safe in lying about them. Southern chivalry protected her. A southern lady could lie about a gentleman, but a southern gentleman could not lie about a lady, or worse still, call the lady a liar. Other lumbermen could only fume inwardly and state heatedly in the bosoms of their families that they wished to God Mrs. Kennedy was a man for just about 5 minutes. One poor white who operated a mill on the Decatur Road did try to fight Scarlett with her own weapons, saying openly that she was a liar and a swindler. But it hurt him rather than helped him, for everyone was appalled that even a poor white should say such shocking things about a lady of good family, even when the lady was conducting herself in such an unwomanly way. Scarlett bore his remarks with silent dignity, and as time went by, she turned all her attention to him and his customers. She undersold him so relentlessly, and delivered with secret groans such an excellent quality of lumber to prove her probity, that he was soon bankrupt. Then, to Frank's horror, she triumphantly bought his mill at her own price. Once in her possession, there arose the perplexing problem of finding a trustworthy man to put in charge of it. She didn't want another man like Mr. Johnson. She knew that despite all her watchfulness, he was still selling her lumber behind her back. But she thought it would be easy to find the right sort of man. Wasn't everybody as poor as Job's turkey? And weren't the streets full of men, some of them formerly rich, who were without work? The day never went by that Frank didn't give money to some hungry ex-soldier, or that Pity and Cookie didn't wrap up food for gaunt beggars. But Scarlet, for some reason she couldn't understand, didn't want any of these. "I don't want men who haven't found something to do after a year," she thought. "If they haven't adjusted to peace yet, they couldn't adjust to me. And they all look so hangdog and licked. I don't want a man who's licked. I want somebody who's smart and energetic, like Rennie or Tommy Welburn, or Kells Whiting, or one of the Simmons boys, or any of that tribe. They haven't got that I-don't-care-about-anything look the soldiers had right after the surrender. They looked like they cared a heap about a heap of things." But to her surprise, the Simmons boys, who had started a brick kill, and Kells Whiting, who was selling a preparation made up in his mother's kitchen that was guaranteed to straighten the kinkiest Negro hair in 6 applications, smiled politely, thanked her, and refused. It was the same with a dozen others she approached. In desperation, she raised the wage she was offering, but she was still refused. One of Mrs. Merriweather's nephews observed impertinently that while he didn't especially enjoy driving a dray, it was his own dray, and he would rather get somewhere under his own steam than Scarlet's. One afternoon, Scarlet pulled up her buggy beside Renee Picard's pie wagon and hailed Renee and the crippled Tommy Welburn, who was catching a ride home with his friend. "Look here, Rennie, why don't you come and work for me? Managing a mill is a sight more respectable than driving a pie wagon. I think you'd be ashamed."
"Me? I am dead to shame," grinned Renee.
"Who would be respectable? All of my days I was respectable until the war set me free like the darkies. Never again must I be dignified and full of ennui, free like the bird. I like my pie wagon. I like my mule. I like the dear Yankees who so kindly buy the pie of Madame Belle-Mère. No, my Scarlet, I must be the king of the pies. It is my destiny. Like Napoleon, I follow my star." He flourished his whip dramatically. "But you weren't raised to sell pies any more than Tommy was raised to wrestle with a bunch of wild Irish masons. My kind of work is more..." "And I supposed you were raised to run a lumber mill," said Tommy, the corners of his mouth twitching. "Yes, I can just see little Scarlet at her mother's knee, lisping her lesson. Never sell good lumber if you can get a better price for bad." Renee roared at this, his small monkey eyes dancing with glee as he whacked Tommy on his twisted back. "Don't be impudent," said Scarlet coldly, for she saw little humor in Tommy's remark. "Of course I wasn't raised to run a sawmill." "I didn't mean to be impudent." "But you are running a sawmill, whether you were raised to it or not. And running it very well, too." "Well, none of us, as far as I can see, are doing what we intended to do right now, but I think we'll make out just the same. It's a poor person and a poor nation that sits down and cries because life isn't precisely what they expected it to be. Why don't you pick up some enterprising carpetbagger to work for you, Scarlet? The woods are full of them, God knows. I don't want a carpetbagger. Carpetbaggers will steal anything that isn't red hot or nailed down.
If they amounted to anything, they'd have stayed where they were instead of coming down here to pick our bones. I want a nice man, from nice folks, who's smart and honest and energetic and... You don't want much. And you won't get it for the wage you're offering. All the men of that description, barring the badly maimed ones, have already got something to do. They may be round pegs in square holes, but they've all got something to do. Something of their own that they'd rather do than work for a woman.
Men haven't got much sense, have they? When you get down to rock bottom.
Maybe not. But they've got a heap of pride, said Tommy soberly.
Pride?
Pride tastes awfully good, especially when the crust is flaky and you put meringue on it, said Scarlet tartly. The two men laughed, a bit unwillingly. And it seemed to Scarlet that they drew together in united masculine disapproval of her.
What Tommy said was true, she thought,
running over in her mind the men she had approached and the ones she intended to approach. They were all busy, busy at something, working hard, working harder than they would have dreamed possible in the days before the war. They weren't doing what they wanted to do, perhaps, or what was easiest to do, or what they had been reared to do. But they were doing something. Times were too hard for men to be choosy, and if they were sorrowing for lost hopes, longing for lost ways of living, no one knew it but they. They were fighting a new war, a harder war than the one before. And they were caring about life again, caring with the same urgency and the same violence that animated them before the war had cut their lives in two. Scarlet, said Tommy awkwardly, I do hate to ask a favor of you after being impudent to you, but I'm going to ask it just the same. Maybe it would help you anyway. My brother-in-law, Hugh Elsing, isn't doing any too well peddling kindling wood. Everybody except the Yankees goes out and collects his own kindling wood, and I know things are mighty hard with the whole Elsing family. I do what I can, but you see, I've got Fanny to support, and then, too, I've got my mother and two widowed sisters down in Sparta to look after. Hugh is nice, and you wanted a nice man, and he's from nice folks, as you know, and he's honest.
But, well, Hugh hasn't got much gumption, or else he'd make a success of his kindling.
Tommy shrugged. You've got a hard way of looking at things, Scarlet, he said. But you think Hugh over. You could go far and do worse.
I think his honesty and his willingness will outweigh his lack of gumption.
Scarlet didn't answer, for she didn't want to be rude. But to her mind there were few, if any, qualities that outweighed gumption. After she had unsuccessfully canvassed the town and refused the importuning of many eager carpetbaggers, she finally decided to take Tommy's suggestion and ask Hugh Elsing. He had been a dashing and resourceful officer during the war, but two severe wounds and 4 years of fighting seemed to have drained him of all his resourcefulness, leaving him to face the rigors of peace as bewildered as a child. There was a lost dog look in his eyes these days, as he went about peddling his firewood, and he was not at all the kind of man she had hoped to get.
He's stupid, she thought. He doesn't know a thing about business, and I'll bet he can't add two and two. And I doubt if he'll ever learn. But at least he's honest and won't swindle me.
Scarlet had little use these days for honesty in herself. But the less she valued it in herself, the more she was beginning to value it in others.
It's a pity Johnny Gallagher is tied up with Tommy Welburn on that construction work, she thought. He's just the kind of man I want. He's hard as nails and slick as a snake. But he'd be honest if it paid him to be honest. I understand him, and he understands me, and we could do business together very well. Maybe I can get him when the hotel is finished. Until then, I'll have to make out on Hugh and Mr. Johnson. If I put Hugh in charge of the new mill and leave Mr. Johnson at the old one, I can stay in town and see to the selling while they handle the milling and the hauling. Until I can get Johnny, I'll have to risk Mr. Johnson robbing me if I stay in town all the time. If only he wasn't a thief. I believe I'll build a lumber yard on half that lot Charles left me. If only Frank didn't holler so loud about me building a saloon on the other half. Well, I shall build the saloon just as soon as I get enough money ahead, no matter how he takes on. If only Frank wasn't so thin-skinned. Oh, God, if only I wasn't going to have a baby at this of all times. In a little while I'll be so big I can't go out. Oh, God, if only I wasn't going to have a baby. And, oh, God, if the damned Yankees will only let me alone. If. There were so many ifs in life. Never any certainty of anything. Never any sense of security. Always the dread of losing everything and being cold and hungry again. Of course, Frank was making a little more money now. But Frank was always ailing with colds and frequently forced to stay in bed for days. Suppose he should become an invalid? No, she could not afford to count on Frank for much. She must not count on anything or anybody but herself. And what she could earn seemed so pitiably small. Oh, what would she do if the Yankees came and took it all away from her? If. Half of what she made every month went to Will at Tara, part to Rhett to repay his loan, and the rest she hoarded. No miser ever counted his gold oftener than she, and no miser ever had greater fear of losing it. She wouldn't put the money in the bank, for it might fail, or the Yankees might confiscate it. So she carried what she could with her, tucked into her corset, and hid small wads of bills about the house, under loose bricks on the hearth, in her scrap bag, between the pages of the Bible. And her temper grew shorter and shorter as the weeks went by, for every dollar she saved would be just one more dollar to lose if disaster descended. Frank, Pity, and the servants bore her outbursts with maddening kindness, attributing her bad disposition to her pregnancy, never realizing the true cause. Frank knew that pregnant women must be humored, so he put his pride in his pocket and said nothing more about her running the mills and her going about town at such a time as no lady should do. Her conduct was a constant embarrassment to him, but he reckoned he could endure it for a while longer. After the baby came, he knew she would be the same sweet, feminine girl he had courted. But in spite of everything he did to appease her, she continued to have her tantrums, and often he thought she acted like one possessed. No one seemed to realize what really possessed her, what drove her like a madwoman. It was a passion to get her affairs in order before she had to retire behind doors, to have as much money as possible in case the deluge broke upon her again, to have a stout levy of cash against the rising tide of Yankee hate. Money was the obsession dominating her mind these days. When she thought of the baby at all, it was with baffled rage at the untimeliness of it. Death and taxes and childbirth. There's never any convenient time for any of them.
Atlanta had been scandalized enough when Scarlett, a woman, began operating the sawmill. But as time went by, the town decided there was no limit to what she would do. Her sharp trading was shocking, especially when her poor mother had been a Robillard, and it was positively indecent the way she kept on going about the streets, when everyone knew she was pregnant. No respectable white woman, and few Negroes ever went outside their homes from the moment they first suspected they were with child. And Mrs. Merriweather declared indignantly that from the way Scarlett was acting, she was likely to have the baby on the public streets. but all the previous criticism of her conduct was as nothing compared with the buzz of gossip that now went through the town. Scarlett was not only trafficking with the Yankees, but was giving every appearance of really liking it. Mrs. Merriweather and many other Southerners were also doing business with the newcomers from the North, but the difference was that they didn't like it, and plainly showed they didn't like it. And Scarlett did, or seemed to, which was just as bad. She had actually taken tea with the Yankee officers' wives in their homes. In fact, she had done practically everything short of inviting them into her own home, and the town guessed she would do even that, except for Aunt Pitty and Frank. Scarlett knew the town was talking, but she didn't care. Couldn't afford to care. She still hated the Yankees with as fierce a hate as on the day when they tried to burn Tara. But she could dissemble that hate. She knew that if she was going to make money, she would have to make it out of the Yankees. And she had learned that buttering them up with smiles and kind words was the surest way to get their business for her mill. Some day, when she was very rich, and her money was hidden away where the Yankees couldn't find it, then she would tell them exactly what she thought of them, tell them how she hated and loathed and despised them, and what a joy that would be. But until that time came, it was just plain common sense to get along with them. And if that was hypocrisy, let Atlanta make the most of it. She discovered that making friends with the Yankee officers was as easy as shooting birds on the ground. They were lonely exiles in a hostile land, and many of them were starved for polite feminine associations in a town where respectable women drew their skirts aside in passing and looked as if they would like to spit on them. Only the prostitutes and the Negro women had kind words for them. But Scarlett was obviously a lady and a lady of family, for all that she worked, and they thrilled to her flashing smile and the pleasant light in her green eyes. Frequently, when Scarlett sat in her buggy talking to them and making her dimples play, her dislike for them rose so strong that it was hard not to curse them to their faces. But she restrained herself. And she found that twisting Yankee men around her finger was no more difficult than that same diversion had been with Southern men. Only this was no diversion, but a grim business. The role she enacted was that of a refined, sweet Southern lady in distress.
With an air of dignified reserve, she was able to keep her victims at their proper distance. But there was nevertheless a graciousness in her manner which left a certain warmth in the Yankee officer's memories of Mrs. Kennedy. This warmth was very profitable, as Scarlett had intended it to be. Many of the officers of the garrison, not knowing how long they would be stationed in Atlanta, had sent for their wives and families. As the hotels and boarding houses were overflowing, they were building small houses, and they were glad to buy their lumber from the gracious Mrs. Kennedy, who treated them more politely than anyone else in town. The carpetbaggers and scalawags also, who were building fine homes and stores and hotels with their new wealth, found it more pleasant to do business with her than with the former Confederate soldiers, who were courteous, but with a courtesy more formal and cold than outspoken hate. So, because she was pretty and charming, and could appear quite helpless and forlorn at times, they gladly patronized her lumber yard, and also Frank's store, feeling that they should help a plucky little woman who apparently had only a shiftless husband to support her. And Scarlett, watching the business grow, felt that she was safeguarding not only the present with Yankee money, but the future with Yankee friends. Keeping her relations with the Yankee officers on the plane she desired was easier than she expected, for they all seemed to be in awe of Southern ladies. But Scarlett soon found that their wives presented a problem she had not anticipated. Contacts with the Yankee women were not of her seeking.
She would have been glad to avoid them, but she couldn't, for the officers' wives were determined to meet her. They had an avid curiosity about the South and Southern women, and Scarlett gave them their first opportunity to satisfy it. Other Atlanta women would have nothing to do with them, and even refused to bow to them in church. So when business brought Scarlett to their homes, she was like an answer to prayer. Often, when Scarlett sat in her buggy in front of a Yankee home talking of uprights and shingles with the man of the house, the wife came out to join in the conversation or insist that she come inside for a cup of tea. Scarlett seldom refused, no matter how distasteful the idea might be, for she always hoped to have an opportunity to suggest tactfully that they do their trading at Frank's store. But her self-control was severely tested many times because of the personal questions they asked and because of the smug and condescending attitude they displayed toward all things Southern. Accepting Uncle Tom's Cabin as revelation second only to the Bible, the Yankee women all wanted to know about the bloodhounds, which every Southerner kept to track down runaway slaves. And they never believed her when she told them she had only seen one bloodhound in all her life, and it was a small, mild dog and not a huge, ferocious mastiff. They wanted to know about the dreadful branding irons which planters used to mark the faces of their slaves, and the cat-o'-nine-tails with which they beat them to death, and they evidenced what Scarlett felt was a very nasty and ill-bred interest in slave concubinage. Especially did she resent this in view of the enormous increase in mulatto babies in Atlanta since the Yankee soldiers had settled in town. Any other Atlanta woman would have expired in rage at having to listen to such bigoted ignorance, but Scarlett managed to control herself. Assisting her in this was the fact that they aroused her contempt more than her anger. After all, they were Yankees, and no one expected anything better from Yankees. So their unthinking insults to her state, her people, and their morals glanced off and never struck deep enough to cause her more than a well-concealed sneer. Until an incident occurred which made her sick with rage and showed her, if she needed any showing, how wide was the gap between North and South, and how utterly impossible it was to bridge it. While driving home with Uncle Peter one afternoon, she passed the house into which were crowded the families of three officers who were building their own homes with Scarlett's lumber. The three wives were standing in the walk as she drove by, and they waved to her to stop. Coming out to the carriage block, they greeted her in accents that always made her feel that one could forgive Yankees almost anything except their voices. "You are just the person I want to see, Mrs. Kennedy," said a tall, thin woman from Maine. "I want to get some information about this benighted town." Scarlett swallowed the insult to Atlanta with the contempt it deserved and smiled her best.
"And what can I tell you?"
"My nurse, my Bridget, has gone back north. She said she wouldn't stay another day down here among the niggers, as she calls them. And the children are just driving me distracted. Do tell me how to go about getting another nurse. I do not know where to apply."
"That shouldn't be difficult," said Scarlett, and laughed. "If you can find a darky just in from the country who hasn't been spoiled by the Freedmen's Bureau, you'll have the best kind of servant possible. Just stand at your gate here and ask every darky woman who passes, and I'm sure..." The three women broke into indignant outcries. "Do you think I'd trust my babies to a black nigger?" cried the Maine woman. "I want a good Irish girl." "I'm afraid you'll find no Irish servants in Atlanta," answered Scarlett, coolness in her voice. "Personally, I've never seen a white servant, and I shouldn't care to have one in my house, and..." She could not keep a slight note of sarcasm from her words. "I assure you that darkies aren't cannibals, and are quite trustworthy." "Goodness, no! I wouldn't have one in my house. The idea! I wouldn't trust them any farther than I can see them. And as for letting them handle my babies...
Scarlet thought of the kind, gnarled hands of Mammy worn rough in Ellen's service, and hers, and Wade's. What did these strangers know of black hands? How dear and comforting they could be. How unerringly they knew how to soothe, to pat, to fondle. She laughed shortly. It's strange you should feel that way when it was